Beloved listeners, and welcome to another hour of Advanced Living Radio. This is Kenneth Lesser, and I'm thrilled and delighted to be your host again. You know, every week we're here to do something in support of having a better life, of taking care of things that you want something to be improved, you want to handle things, and you want it to be easy. And this is what we specialize here. Little tidbits, sometimes power information, every little piece of the puzzle to help you to live better and to have that come with a nice ease and grace and flow. And this is because I daily pray, Heavenly Father, show me the best ways to have the most fun, inspiring the largest number of people to easily, naturally, joyously experience vibrantly, exquisitely, healthy, wealthy, passionate living in the shortest amount of time with the least intrusion into their lives so we can get all our needs met and celebrate a global loving community that works for everyone. Well, yes, that's ambitious, and step by step, we're getting there. And as we get into the show, I want to remind you it is brought to you by AdvancedLiving.com, home of the comfort technology. When you go to AdvancedLiving.com, you'll see people like Jack Canfield, Michael Beckwith, Dr. Eva Selhove, a Harvard MD, that are using this plug-in device that harmonizes energy. That's kind of like you plug it in and you get to sleep better, you get to feel better, reduces conflict, irritation, agitation. It's an easy, easy thing. So take a look at AdvancedLiving.com. Today, guess what, folks? You know you've probably heard, well, you've got to take time and relax. Well, what if you're too busy to sit down and meditate? And so many of us are. Well, what would you like to learn to create that state of mind through your daily activities? Well, guess what? Self-observation without judgment or without the interference by the mind becomes, yes, meditation in action. All right. Now, if that doesn't make total sense to you yet, that's why you've tuned in, because you get to listen to a dear, dear soul named Red Hawk. And he was the hotter fellow in the humanities at Princeton University in 1991 and 92, and is currently professor of English at the University of Arkansas in Monticello. Extensive writing, his poetry books, Journey of the Medicine Man, that was a finalist in the Walt Whitman Award, The Sioux Dog Dance, was a runner-up in the Patterson Poetry Prize, The Way of Power, The Art of Dying, and one that jumped out at me, Wreckage with a Beating Heart. That one's like, I wonder. And then Raven's Paradise, which is a book-length poem, 65 pages and 42 sections, and it won the 2009 Bright Hill Press National Poetry Book Competition and is due to be published next April of 2010. We're going to be discussing some of his nonfiction book, which is Self-Observation, The Awakening of Conscience. And he has his poetry, you can find it in the magazines The Atlantic, Kenyon Review, Poetry, Atlantic Review, Shenandoah, and many others. And on a personal note, he has two terrific daughters who live in California. And, of course, he's in the opposite end of the country in Monticello, Arkansas, with his sweetheart, it looks like Chandrika.
Chandrika, yeah.
Yes. And, of course, as we've mentioned, has been for a number of years a poet, a professor of English at the University of Arkansas. Now, get ready, folks. We're going to find out something about this self-observation and how to make our lives better by doing that. So welcome, Red Hawk.
Thank you so much, Ken. I'm glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. There's so much going on. It's busy lives and global warming and the financial crisis and the impending 2012, the apocalypse, the end of the world, just so many things going on. And so it's kind of exciting to pause a little bit and hear, wait, we can get a wonderful meditative state of mind without having to sit and meditate. So I'm interested because in your book, the first line of your book says, "Know thyself." I'm just wondering, what exactly does that mean?
Ken, I love the very simple explanation you gave about self-observation as meditation in action. Look, there are many ways to meditate. And there's classic Eastern meditation, which is sitting on a cushion, and we know that's very, very useful, very valuable. I do it every day. But what about the rest of the day? And what about the tensions of the day? And what does it mean that I don't know myself? Well, we are taught in our culture many great lies that keep us trapped in a certain kind of mindset. One of the lies we're taught is that I am what I think I am. I'm always one and the same inside. I am not a mass of contradictions. So self-observation is simply turning the spotlight around. Instead of judging other people, instead of judging myself, I begin to very patiently begin to notice what I am, my thoughts, my emotions. I begin to face my own contradictions. You mentioned global warming and the financial meltdown. Look, the human race is facing a tremendously crucial time in our history where we could eliminate ourselves from the face of the planet. We are in the midst of the sixth great extinction on this planet. The fifth great extinction happened 65 million years ago with the dinosaurs. We are losing 30,000 species a year from the planet, mostly because of human activity. We have a global financial meltdown. We have global warming and the poisoning of the atmosphere, the poisoning of the water, and the poisoning of the soil. Cancer is in epidemic proportion because it is an environmental illness. Humans act without conscience on this planet. We act as if the resources of the planet are infinite instead of in very short supply and non-renewable. We live at the end of the oil age, and at the end of the oil age, we're going to see a financial crisis that will make what we've just been through minuscule. Many civilizations and most of the world's economic structure is faced with dire collapse, imminent collapse. We are faced with species death. We are in the midst of one of two possibilities for human beings. Either there is a great paradigm shift. That is, the old ways don't work. We see they don't work. We're getting all kinds of warning signs that they don't work. And there has to be a great paradigm shift. The old paradigm is that I can do anything I want. I can live any way I want. I can squander all that I want. I can waste. I can pillage. And I don't have to care about my neighbor or about the earth. That doesn't work anymore. we live in a moral universe. By the way, Ken, I loved your prayer. What a beautiful thing that was that you began your program with. That prayer recognizes that we live in a moral universe. The ruling principle of that universe is love. And your prayer, I think, acknowledges that. Am I right about that?
Yes.
Yeah. And we are an immoral species in a moral universe. We think that we have conscience. Well, the fact is, every human being ever born on the planet is born with a mustard seed of conscience. That mustard seed has to be developed consciously. It doesn't develop automatically. If it did, we would live in paradise, wouldn't we?
Yes, yes.
But it doesn't develop automatically and mechanically. It requires that I make great sacrifices in my life, that I undergo a certain amount of suffering, because, you know, we know that suffering produces compassion. We know that suffering produces a conscience. So we've forgotten who we are. We've forgotten why we're here. We've forgotten what we're meant to be doing as human beings. Now, here's where it gets really interesting, Ken. We, in this human body, exist a non-human entity, which we call a soul. Other spiritual traditions call it a spirit. The Native Americans call it spirit. Some call it different kinds of bodies. But there is this soul in the body, and this soul is attention. The soul is attention. It is meant to develop as attention. So we are meant to develop our attention, and that developing of attention is how the soul develops. Well, we live in a culture now where the attention is being destroyed by television, by computers, by cell phones, by iPods. Our attention span is very weak, very, very short. We are trained to have an attention span of seconds and then constantly shifting images. So we don't know how to observe ourselves, and therefore we don't know how to learn. We forget who we are. We are here as souls to develop and to learn, and conscience is the means by which that development is directed. Self-observation is the means by which we develop.
Wow. Wow. So that's so huge.
It's huge.
Yeah, the harder it's become, as you say, with all the onslaught of things in that term, sound bites, where I want to see this, I want to see that, stimulate.
Yeah. And I think your word onslaught is right. It's the right word, Ken. There's an avalanche of things that are conflicting us in our everyday life. And so we forget, we get identified with those things, the constant onslaught of images about buy this, buy that, own this, own that, be this, be that. And we get very seduced by those things. And so we forget that we are A, spiritual beings, B, moral beings, and C, non-human entities in a human body.
Ah, now there's a nice combination.
Yes.
Now I'm just wondering, the path of that you're talking about of self-observation. I'm just wondering how can we utilize some of that in the midst of all of this stuff to sort of reclaim the high ground, so to speak.
Well, that's exactly what we must do if we're to survive as a species on this planet, is to find my own higher being inside this body. This body is a mammal, and so it's very interesting because I have to learn about what mammals do and how they operate, because the body is a mammal body. Mammals are herd animals. Herd animals don't think for themselves. Herd animals follow the herd. They go where the herd goes. They do what the herd does. Well, the herd is destroying the earth. The herd is using up all of the natural resources. the herd created an economy and a society based on cheap oil and plentiful oil. That time is over. So we live a wounded relationship. We live a wounded relationship with ourselves. We live a wounded relationship with others. We live a wounded relationship with the earth, which is the source of all of our life. I think I'm going to read the first poem in the book. The book is prose. Each chapter ends with a poem, one of my poems, that illustrates what that chapter is about. And this is the prologue to the book. So this is the prologue. It's called The Teaching, and it's about self-observation. It is as old as the stones. It came with humans to the earth, and it offers them a way out of the web of sorrows, but at a price. We must observe ourselves, our behavior, our inner and outer responses, objectively. This means without taking a personal interest or doing anything about the horror which self-observation uncovers. Like a bad boy with a stick, overturning a stone and finding a mass of crawling things beneath, but he refrains from stomping on them.
On behalf of those little crawly things, I want to thank you.
You're welcome. Look, self-observation, Ken, is about beginning to face my own contradictions. And I'm not going to like what all that I see in me. I have pretended to be a certain way. I've believed that I am a certain way. But the fact is, when I'm at home, I'm different than when I'm in front of the public. When I'm with my friends, I'm different than when I'm with my wife. Many, many, many different selves exist in this body, and they are often contradictory. For example, I'll find sometimes that I'm mean-spirited, that I say things that hurt other people. And afterwards, I'll say to myself, what was I thinking? I don't know why I said that. Well, the fact is that we don't know ourselves, and that's why we're able to do the things we do. That's why we're able to destroy the earth. Self-observation is ancient. In the Gospels, Jesus calls it witnessing. Witnessing is simply a recognition that in this body is a being which is a silent witness. That being, some call it a soul, is never speaks, it never forces itself, it's never aggressive, it never insists, it never judges, and it does not speak. It is silent. It communicates with me, with the body, by feeling, so that the silent witness in me is capable of viewing my thoughts, capable of viewing my emotions, capable of viewing my habits, and doing so in an objective way, that is, non-judgmentally. We are attention in a mammal body, and this attention that I am is very weak, it's undeveloped, it's uneducated. The means to develop myself as attention is self-observation. So that there is this split in me. I see what's external to me, and I begin to notice what's internal to me, because, Ken, it's the internal world where all of the human action takes place.
Wow.
Your prayer acknowledges that. The prayer that you start your program with acknowledges that there is an inner world in me, and that I must begin to take responsibility for that inner world.
Yes.
So self-observation, Ken, begins to develop, to build an internal matrix. It replaces the external mother. It replaces the matrix of the earth with an internal matrix, something stable, something conscious, something which is the same always, which isn't caught by every external breeze, every external action, that circumstance that happens to me, something which is absolutely stable and can be trusted, can be counted on, can be utilized. Socrates called it seeing. Buddha calls it looking. There have been many names for self-observation. But conscious attention is how we mature and develop as souls. It's how the soul cares and nurtures for itself. Look, as children, we develop these survival strategies, these habits. It's how a child protects and cares for itself. But what once protected us can now imprison us, these habits that we have. I call that the box.
Mm.
We have created this box for ourselves so that we don't get hurt, so that we can make life predictable. And you and I both know, Ken, that life is not predictable. The more I try to make it predictable, the more I manipulate and control it, the more I miss my life and the joy of life. I loved your prayer because you talked about the joy of life. And that's what we miss because we are driven by these old survival strategies. Self-observation seeks to see and feel those messages, those commands, those thoughts and emotions which we created as a little children. They limit our abilities. They limit our possibilities. I don't know if you know who Werner Heisenberg was. He was a German physicist. Have you ever heard his name?
Is that the Heisenberg principle?
That's it. Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. Heisenberg's uncertainty principle stated a very simple but profound truth which changed the way we did physics in the 20th century. His principle said, observing any process changes the process. So that is a profound law which can change my life, because what it means is that I don't have to do anything about this mass of contradictions which I am. My
Wow.
relationships don't work. My life isn't working. I don't have to do anything about what I observe. All I have to do is to begin to observe my thoughts and my emotions without judgment. And the very act of observation is a profound change in human life.
Huh. Now, there's a gentleman from Louisiana that's a kind of a Cajun singer, Tab Lenoir, and he was traveling, and one of the things he was chatting with the audience, and I was at one of his performances, and I'm wondering how this ties in with what you're talking about. He said that one of the helpful things that he's done with his life, because he's been a performer, is when he's not on stage in front of people, he's said to himself quite often, now, how would I be acting in this situation if I knew people were watching me?
It's wonderful, because you see, it's wonderful what you just said. We live our lives by habit because we're mammals. Mammals are creatures of habit. They repeat the same behavior over and over again without consciousness, without awareness. I live my life without being observed inside. The moment the observer awakens in me, the moment this witnessing consciousness awakens in me, these habits come under scrutiny. They aren't used to being scrutinized. They aren't used to being observed. They're used to being lived out mechanically, automatically. We are used to living our lives on automatic pilot. The moment an observer awakens in me, these habits begin to change on their own because I become more conscious. The more conscious I am, the less habitual I become. The more conscious I am, the less I am driven by habit. And look, I have emotional habits, for example. People say a certain thing to me and I react a certain way. People treat me a certain way, I react a certain way. And all of these reactive mechanisms in me are old, habitual mechanisms in me. The act of observation, I begin to act as if somebody were watching me, because that's the fact. I begin to watch myself, and I don't act in the same old ways, because I see that those old ways, some of them are very disturbing.
Yes. Now, here, there's an old saying that has come up that I'm wondering, this kind of ties in a way, I think.
Yeah.
The saying says, be your own best friend. And I've kind of wondered, well, geez, how do you be your own best friend, or what's that like? And now I think you're giving us some of the answer here.
I love what you just said, because what does it mean to truly befriend myself? Okay, look, we are the only species on Earth, as far as I know, that has two natures in one body. We have our animal, mammal nature, which is the body, and we have this being, which is a non-human entity. The soul is an angelic being. Now, do you love that?
Yeah.
The soul is an angelic being. We are a race of angelic beings who have been put on Earth and given human bodies in order that we might learn. Well, what are we here to learn? Simple. We're here to learn unconditional love. That's the soul's agenda. We forget that that's what we're here to learn, because we get so distracted. So what does it mean to become my own best friend? Well, first of all, it means that the soul is capable of befriending the body in the same way that a good master is capable of befriending a dog or a cat or a pet. The soul is an angelic being who is not fully formed. And we're here to educate ourselves. So the first task is to tame the mammal body without harming it, without breaking it. You know, you break horses. Well, Monty Roberts, the horse whisperer, showed us that that's not necessary to break a horse in order to tame it and get it to cooperate. Our first task as a soul is to study the mammal body, learn its habits, and learn how to befriend it without hurting it, without scaring it, and get it to cooperate with us in our agenda of learning unconditional love.
Wow. I love it, because so much of the habit and behavior change talks about willpower, which
absolutely
is kind of like force, and
forcing it. And you know, the thing is, it never works right. When I try to force change on myself, there's always this reaction. You know, I'm gonna stop eating so much. I'm gonna stop eating sweets, and then that works for a day or two, and then we go on a binge, and then we feel guilty, and then it goes back and forth, and there's this never-ending cycle of guilt and shame, and trying to stop, and stopping for a little while, and then substituting one habit for another. I stop smoking, and I start eating too much, or I get short-tempered with my people I love. This kind of force, this kind of aggression and violence is not necessary. It doesn't work. It doesn't work on our children. It doesn't work on us. Self-observation is patient. It only works as fast as I only grow as fast as I'm able to build an inner matrix. So I only observe as much as I can observe and as much as I have the energy to do that. And then I have to rest. And then I build up more energy, and I remember to observe a little more. I come back. I notice that I haven't been observing myself. I've been on automatic pilot. I come back to the body. I sense the body. I live my life in the body. Now, here's the interesting thing, Ken. We talk about my life. Everybody talks about my life. But the fact is, my life is the life of the body. My life is being lived in the body. And yet I am being trained from the time I'm little to live my life solely in my head, solely as a thinking mechanism. And basically what I am is a pole walking around with a head on it. I don't feel my feelings. And, you know, it reminds me of these poor little hunched over people in a hospital corridor pulling along this thing with this glass bottle hanging down and a tube in their arms. That's what we are. And we don't know. We forget to feel our bodies. We forget to experience our lives. Our lives are going on below our necks. So I teach people, move your attention below the neck into the body again. Locate it around the solar plexus so that we begin to feel our feelings, all of our feelings. We're afraid of our feelings. We're afraid because we were hurt when we were children. We're afraid to feel. And especially as men, Ken, we're taught not to feel anymore. We're trained not to feel. On the playground, if I'm a kind, gentle, sensitive, very, very loving boy, oh, man, the bullies have a field day with me. Very quickly, as men, we're taught that the only emotion that we're safe to express is anger. Most human beings can live their emotional lives out of either one of two states, fear or anger. Self-observation allows me to begin to feel that anger and that fear without trying to change it, without trying to force anything. As I observe, I begin to see that that's not who I am.
Wow, what you're sharing, there's a popular movement with a movie, The Secret, and then books and people talking about that. And what's so interesting, one of the key factors was to notice on an emotional level, am I feeling good? Am I not feeling good? And, of course, there's been so many people frustrated by not being able to put a focus of attention on things and use that law of attraction. And then here you're giving one of the keys. Until we can become that observer, we're really not going to be able to determine, well, how am I feeling?
And then absolutely. Now, you mentioned the law of attraction. Let's talk about that for a minute, because that's one of the laws that governs our lives. I am what attracts me. Whatever I'm attracted to, I become that. Well, for most of us, that means that we are attracted by a consumer mentality, a consumer society, and a society which is consuming the earth and all its resources. That means that we live in one of the most selfish societies on earth. It doesn't have to be that way. What am I attracted to? Well, if I begin to awaken the observing power in me, then I become very much interested and attracted by the forces which are at play in my body. I become attracted by my feelings. I get interested in my feelings. I get interested in my emotions. I become attracted to them. I get interested in my thoughts. I am attracted to them. But more than anything else, Ken, I become attracted by my own body. Ken, the body is a miracle. It is one of the great miracles of all creation. Because humans have this capacity to know themselves. Dogs don't have it. Cats don't have it. Elephants don't have it. No mammal has it. As far as I know, the only species on earth capable of knowing itself is the human beings. We have a neocortex. We have a large thinking brain, a dreaming brain. And the thing about the neocortex, Ken, is it's full of latent potential possibilities that go virtually unused. Let's talk about the law of attraction again. This soul, which doesn't know itself, existing in the body and totally caught and immersed and lost in the desires of the body, when it awakens just a little and begins to observe the functions of the body, it begins to notice that it's not those functions. slowly, slowly, I begin to be aware that I'm not just the body, I'm not just the emotions, I'm not these thoughts that have been programmed into me. I am something else. And the soul begins to be attracted to itself. And it begins to awaken to what it is. Well, the soul is love. The soul is a force which is capable of miraculous things. It's capable of forgiveness. It's capable of kindness. It's capable of generosity and compassion. It begins to be attracted to these higher, finer elements which it's composed of, but don't have a play in the ordinary habitual life of the human body. The human emotions are basically four things: mad, sad, glad, scared. Mad, sad, glad, scared. Those are the four basic human emotions. And we are trapped into a life in which that's our only response to life. Mad, sad, glad, scared. Well, what about joy? What about unconditional love? What about remorse? What about grief? What about compassion? These are feelings. They aren't emotions. They are higher feelings. They are emotion refined. Self-observation refines the emotions so that I begin to have a vast range of higher feelings that are available to me, and my life begins to bloom in a brand new way because I'm no longer trapped in the old paradigm of the childish response, fear and anger.
Wow. Now, for one of the things that you had mentioned, love, and I have to kind of maybe take a little divergence here.
Sure.
Page 125 of your book, which,
good,
by the way, when people want to get your book, what's the best way for them to do that?
Thank you. This book is available from Home Press. Home is spelled H-O-H-M, so it's Ohm with an H on it, HOHMPress.com. You can also order it from Amazon.com. It's available now. And so I urge you to take a look at it. If you get interested in how to observe yourself and do it in a safe way so that there's no harm, so that there's no fear, how to do that, this book tells you how to do that.
And now here is something that...
Page 121, right?
125. There's
yeah.
This poem called Love is Not a Feeling.
Yes.
And I don't know if... you'd be okay with reading that and sharing
I'll read
what it means?
Can I read that to you?
Yeah, please.
It's a sonnet for all those who are listening who weren't paying attention in ninth grade when your teacher was teaching you about sonnets, and that's most of us. I was looking at the pretty girls, and the pretty girls were looking at the attractive boys. A sonnet is a 14-line poem. Shakespeare was the master of the sonnet in English. It rhymes in a certain way. This poem is for one of my dear friends, Smitty. And by the way, I want to mention Lynn at Vintage Bookstores in Russellville. They're tuning this program in live to the whole bookstore, and people are listening right now. Love is not a feeling. Love is not a feeling. It is a commitment etched in stone. But belief in the feeling sends us reeling from one failure to another. We end up alone, broken, and cynical. Love is not a feeling. It is a reliable daily practice. No matter what I feel, I am not concealing it, but letting it be. She may be prickly as cactus and not at all easy on the eye. The feeling may be disgust. Or let us say she is most lovely and the feeling is lust. Both turn to dust. Still, the commitment to practice is steady. Doesn't depend on whether I'm feeling ready. So, now that's a very challenging poem because we assume love is a feeling. Well, it is a feeling. But there's more to love than just the feeling, because I don't always feel love, Ken.
Yes.
Sometimes I'm angry. Sometimes I'm hurt. Sometimes I don't want to be nice to you. Well, okay, so this poem suggests that with self-observation, love becomes a commitment and a practice, not just a feeling. I wake up some days and I don't feel very loving, Ken. I go to school, I eat lunch, I eat too much or I eat the wrong food and it upsets my stomach. I don't feel very loving. With self-observation, something develops in the body, which is a non-human entity. We call it the soul. The soul begins to grow stronger. It begins to have a moral force in the body, which is called conscience. And this conscience begins to guide me and begin, it doesn't speak now. It's silent. Jesus called it the silent witness. It is a feeling. But this feeling teaches me. I develop aims. One of my aims, Ken, is to be kind. No matter the circumstances, no matter how you treat me, no matter what you call me or say to me, my aim is to be kind. So that when I'm not feeling loving, I practice being loving even when I don't feel it. When I'm not feeling like forgiving you, you've hurt me badly, I practice love. I'm committed to that practice even when I don't feel it. I want to bring in this beautiful example, Ken. A year and a half ago in Pennsylvania, there was a school, an Amish school. A madman broke into that school with a rifle. He lined six little girls up against the wall and murdered them and then killed himself. Do you remember that incident?
I don't.
That's a year and a half ago. Now here's what the Amish community did. The next day, they gathered together, they baked food, they took the food to the family of the killer. They sat down with that family and forgave them. They fed that family. They began to commiserate with that family and grieve with that family because their son had gone crazy and killed these little girls and then killed himself. It was a great act of compassion and Christian charity. Now look, my child has been murdered. I don't feel love, but they practiced and were committed to the practice of unconditional love, even when they were shattered, their world was shattered, their hearts were broken. That's what I mean by love is not a feeling. The feeling sometimes may be there, sometimes it's not. But love is a commitment. Love is a practice. No matter the circumstances, no matter how I'm feeling or my mood.
Yes, wow. It makes me wonder a little bit in terms of the idea of some people's spiritual practice of being here, but when it's all over, reuniting with Source, God,
absolutely,
Buddha, the Father,
yeah,
and being able to have less attachment to the ups and downs of this merry-go-round that
we're
on.
That's right, because you see, what self-observation does is it creates in me an objectivity. Objectivity means that I'm not attached to the things of this world anymore. I am interested in them, I participate in them, but I'm not attached to them, and I call that in my book identification. Attachment is identification. I identify myself with my car, my job, my house, my spouse, my children, the college I went to, the clothes I wear, the money I make. No, those kinds of worldly attachments prevent love from manifesting in me in a clear, smooth way. I interfere with love coming through me. Now, let's talk again about love is not a feeling. Love doesn't come from me. Love comes from our Creator. Our Creator is love. In the Christian tradition, Jesus says in the Gospel, God is love. It's a very simple teaching, but it's profound. Love and God are the same thing. In this world, which was created by a loving God, this world was created by love. Love is the language by which the Creator communicates with its creation. Love is the way the Creator manifests in this world. So whatever interferes with love has to be set aside. Self-observation simply shows me why I'm not able to love you unconditionally moment to moment. And by observing those things, they are burned away by the act of observation. Slowly, slowly, what gets in the way of the Creator manifesting in my body, through my body, is burned away. So that I no longer interfere with love coming to me and through me. Love flows through me like a river if I don't get in the way. Self-observation teaches me to not get in the way.
Ah. So,
and conscience is the guide that develops in me, which shows me when I'm getting in the way. Conscience. Everyone's born with a mustard seed of it, even Hitler, even Mussolini, even Joseph Stalin, even Mao Zedong, the great murderers of our time, all were born with a mustard seed of conscience. Self-observation is the means by which conscience develops. Conscience begins to show me by feeling when I am getting in the way of love.
Ah. Huh. How wonderful. And what I love about the poem, as you're talking about a way to bridge to that, is when I'm reading this and listening to it, I'm imagining how, as adults, we observe. Men looking at women looking at men, and you're inviting people to go beyond the external and see more than that. And then it was like, okay, if we recall back to childhood, or working with a little tiny baby, we observe the baby. It's not like, no, we don't want a baby that makes a mess. Well, babies make a mess.
Yeah.
So that's one of the times where I think a lot of people are able to observe and still continue to love.
Let's talk about childhood for a minute, Ken. In the Gospels, again, in the Christian tradition, the Master Jesus says, to enter the gates of heaven, first ye must be like a little child. Well, that's a profound teaching. What is it? It doesn't mean that I am a child. A child is an innocent being, but a child's innocence hasn't been paid for. It was born that way. That innocence is very quickly destroyed by our world so that we lose our innocence. Self-observation shows me the way back to my innocence, but this is not a child's innocence. This is the wise innocence of one who has suffered, one who observes all those things in myself which prevent love from happening spontaneously and flowing effortlessly. I suffer when I see what I am and how I prevent love. And I suffer, all of us suffer. Buddha said, all life is suffering. Well, that's true. It doesn't have to be that way. Self-observation shows me the way out of my suffering because it shows me how I am making my own suffering. And you see, the act of observation, slowly, slowly, those things melt away that I do to create my own suffering and those things I do to sabotage my own loving relationships.
Wow.
52% divorce rate in this country,
yeah.
Ken.
Yeah, exactly. So there's room for improvement, to say the least.
Well, and that's why we're here. We're here as souls to improve, and in fact, we're here to perfect ourselves. Well, what does it mean to be perfect? It doesn't mean I never make mistakes, Ken. That's too foolish. Everybody does. Perfection means that I see my mistakes, I take responsibility for them, I don't blame others. I don't justify or excuse them. I learn from every mistake. That's called the path of perfection.
Ah.
See, is that beautiful? I don't have to put myself down for making mistakes. I simply have to begin to learn from them without judging myself harshly, without condemning or criticizing myself. Look, we're too hard on ourselves. We don't have compassion for ourselves. If I don't have compassion for myself, I can't have compassion for others. Compassion for myself means I don't excuse my mistakes. I don't blame others for my mistakes. But I don't condemn myself for them. I look at the mistake. I get everything, every kind of, whatever lesson is in the mistake, I utilize it. By self-observation, it teaches the soul to learn how to learn.
Yes. Now, here, what to me is so key, that they say, biblically, judge not lest you be judged. In your book, you mentioned judgment as a trap. So I was just thinking, when we think of love as a river, and it's flowing, then I thought to myself, well, perhaps we could say that judgment would be like an impediment to the river, where we build a dam or something blocks it. And then I thought, oh my gosh, judgment is one damn thing after another.
Oh, that's good. Ken, I'm going to steal that line, and I'm not going to give you any credit for it. Look, let's talk about judgment. Boy, that's such an intelligent thing you just said. Look, I forget. I think it's Corinthians that says love.
That's a gift of love to you, by the way, Red Hawk.
Thank you very much. I love you. Love doesn't judge, Ken. That's the simple fact about love. That's why we are so attracted to those who love us, because at first we don't judge each other, because we see purely through the eyes of love. And then the mind intrudes and begins to see our faults and our weaknesses and begins to make these lists and begins to make us pay for our faults and the mistakes we make. Judgment is a trap. Judgment, if I'm judging, I'm not observing. Judgment is the result of identification, of attachment. And you see, what I begin to see is that I am not my emotions. I'm not my thoughts. Can I begin to observe without reacting to what I see? For example, I'm going to read you another poem from the book. This poem is called Equanimity, and equanimity is one of the aims of Buddhism. Equanimity, to be without judgment, which is not the same as being without discrimination, is equanimity. To move neither toward hot nor away from cold, but to remain stable as desire strains at the leash. Perhaps you have seen the ancient symbol for equanimity. Between two opposing lions, the low setting sun sits unmoved on the horizon, its light illuminating equally the no and the yes. The Indians gave it no name, but said, regard eating the bear and the bear eating you, both the same. That's equanimity. Look, judgment is not discrimination. That's what that poem says. Conscience never judges, Ken. Conscience is silent. It doesn't speak. If there are words, it's not conscience. If there's judgment, it's not conscience. Discrimination comes from real feelings. Discrimination is my ability to instantly know what is the right course of action for me, what is not the right course of action for me. It's a whole body knowing. It's not judging, it's not condemning, it's not putting anybody down. It's simply saying, no, that's not for me, that's not the way I want to do it. Discrimination, the conscience sees things whole, not in parts. It responds with the mind and the heart in harmony together, Ken, instead of the mind alone, which is how we live most of our lives. The mind is doing all of the work. It's always thinking. Conscience uses mind and heart together. It uses insight, intuition, and inspiration, which is called enlightened intelligence, by the way. Intuition, inspiration, and insight together are enlightened intelligence. That's the mind the heart and the body operating as a single unified whole. Conscience knows right action from feeling, not thinking, and not words. Judgment comes from emotion and from thought. It's always a lie. It's always from the past. It's always from fear. It labels and puts people in boxes. It puts me in a box. It's based on belief systems. It's an intellectual reaction. It's an emotional reaction. And the conscience is not judgmental. That's what we have to know. We can stop putting ourselves down. We can stop condemning ourselves and simply begin to observe. Look, if I
now,
eat too many cookies...
I may want to share something. I'm feeling like we're just getting warmed up, and we're at the end of the hour.
Absolutely. Well, it's been a wonderful conversation.
Thank you, and to all of our listeners in Arkansas and everywhere else, thank you. Thank you for tuning in, and thank you, Red Hawk, for blessing
us. Let me mention homepress.com, HOHMPress.com, or Amazon.com.
The book
is Self-Observation, The Awakening of Conscience. Ken, you're a wonderful host. Thank you.
You're welcome. God bless you.
God bless you.
Listeners. And until we meet again, God bless and goodbye for now. Let's go.